You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Samora Pinderhughes. Samora is a beautiful pianist, composer, and an activist. He went to Juilliard in the jazz department right after I graduated, and he did some outreach work there with my husband. But we've recently reconnected, and I'm so glad that we did. His energy is delightful to be in a room with, and his hard work and activism is very inspiring to me. We cover a lot of ground in this conversation, but specifically, I wanted to shout out that Samora's long-term project, The Transformations Suite, was just released this week on October 12th, 2016. It's an incredible album that reflects the current state of social inequality and injustice in the United States and beyond. So stick around at the end of the episode to hear a track off the album. I hope you enjoy the 49th episode of The Compass. How do you keep from going to the dark side as an artist? And what is the dark side for you? Like, if you're feeling really down, what is it that's taking you there?
I have definitely had a lot of experiences with that. I mean, I definitely have had my own kind of battles with whatever one would call, you know, depression or things like that. And the music has definitely been helpful for me to actually just talk about that stuff, because one of the, I guess at least the characteristics of it for me is that my own kind of mind is telling me not to tell other people about it.
Yeah.
And so the weird kind of paradox of it is I somehow feel more comfortable doing it in front of like 200 people as a song than I feel talking about it with one person, even if I really know them really well.
Yeah.
So it's been nice to have those kind of points of release. Also, I think in the music sometimes I can do and be certain things that I think at least feel very dangerous for me to be as a person, like being very aggressive. You know, I don't want to be aggressive towards another person,
but right,
I can do that in the music if I need to, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do need to do those things as a person to get certain feelings out, you know, yell or whatever. So if I need to do that in the music, that's a safe outlet for me to do that where I'm not hurting other people. So I think that's been another way. I didn't really know that that was true till I did it, and then I was like, oh, didn't know I needed that, you know?
Yeah.
So that, I think that has been helpful. And just, you know, being able to have a form where I can talk about very difficult things but still try to make it beautiful. Because, you know, that's why I do music, is because I love beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting paradox to try to take those kind of things that I think are very ugly about myself and try to make them beautiful to
yeah.
other people.
Yeah, totally.
While still trying to retain the honesty of what they are. So, I mean, I like that. But I also do think that it can also be not the right lifestyle for somebody that has those tendencies. At the same time, you know, because like...
The artist life.
You know, yeah, just, you know, it being very uncertain and not consistent in any way.
Yeah. And vulnerable too, because yeah, it's like you're vulnerable. Part of the thing that you're trying to get people behind.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, I made this chair. Take true. The chair. It's like it's part of you.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. The fact that your whole kind of livelihood is based on the idea that you're giving of yourself is a little strange sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you someone who likes structure and kind of yearns for that kind of control? As a jazz musician, I would think that you were the opposite, but...
I think I'm naturally the opposite. I think I always tell myself I need more structure, but I don't actually do that. it's tough with, like, touring and just the type of way I like to write. I like to write in the nighttime, and like, but I like to practice in the morning, so I kind of choose... So yeah, I don't really have much consistency in my life, but I think I'm trying to introduce a few more elements of it in certain ways, just because it's nice to have some things that are consistent so that everything else can be a little bit more wild.
Yeah, like what kind of stuff?
Like diet.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't succeeded with that one yet.
I'm
trying.
Self-care.
Just like the first things you do when you get up in the morning. Like, I think, like, going and do, like, responding to things in the morning, mm-hmm. not good, which is usually what I do, you know, responding to email or responding to what you had to do the night. Like, you should do something active first, I think.
Right.
And something that's, like, healthy for yourself first, and then you can respond. Because if you respond in the morning, you'll probably just be responding the whole day, you know?
Right, right. Well, and also to, like, see your, give yourself space to be a human being first. Yeah. Thank you, Loud Chucks. Before, like, turning into a business machine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Those are things I'm totally working on.
Yeah. Yeah, that uncertainty, it's a beast.
Yeah.
I guess you have to find a way to try to turn it into a positive thing, but I know that's hard for me.
Part of what makes them good is that they're pushing themselves and they always want to be better and stuff like that, which I would consider myself, you know, to want to feel that way all the time.
Like self-motivated.
But the flip side is that it doesn't really, you learn that it doesn't really matter like what successes you have or those kind of things like benchmarks that you think will make you feel one way. It doesn't really change. It's more about what you realize is more internal, how you have to kind of train yourself to feel about the process and other things like that, because it doesn't, it doesn't actually, like, you think, you know, oh, if I, like, hit this thing or whatever, I'm going to feel like a success. But
mm-hmm.
that's really not what happens. You still feel like, oh, that wasn't good, you know.
Right.
So you have to learn to hopefully, like, enjoy more of the process and try to, you know, be easy on yourself and get with that.
Yes. I know. And I think sometimes you think that, oh, well, if I get this one success, then everything after it is going to line up.
Right.
And lead to the next and the next and the next, and that's not always the case. You might have a huge success and then a quiet few years, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's all about defining for yourself as an artist what is making you happy.
Definitely.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in New York, but I moved to the Bay Area when I was like less than a year old. So I grew up in Berkeley, California, and I lived there till I moved to New York for Juilliard. So my whole, you know, growing up life was out there. I love the Bay.
Like, it's beautiful.
Place. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love New York too, but, and they're actually similar in certain ways, but the Bay is definitely, I'm glad I like grew up there. That's like my personality, you know? And I feel like you can always, with people who really grew up there, like you can tell each other like, oh, you were
from there. It was a kinship.
Yeah.
And when did you start playing music?
I started when I was two.
Wow.
Like, I started playing percussion. I was in preschool, and this teacher came to our preschool, and I was, like, being annoying and, like, following her everywhere. So she went to my parents and was like, I want to be his teacher, and so she was my first teacher. And I was playing, like, Latin percussion for a long time, hand drums and stuff, and then I switched to piano when I was seven.
Okay.
So, and then from there, I kind of left the drums behind.
How does your family feel about you being a musician?
They're very supportive. I'm very lucky about that. My sister is also a musician.
Oh, really?
Yes, she's a little...
This is older or younger?
She's 21. We live together, actually.
Oh, my gosh.
And she goes to Manhattan School of Music and plays whatever. She's amazing also. Incredible musician. Flute player and singer. Her name's Elena. And so, you know, we kind of grew up together. And I think that was one of the reasons that my parents were very supportive, was that they could see that it made us close, and that was the most important thing to them, was that, you know, we were very close as siblings. So because that was like what we would mostly do, was like play together and stuff when we were growing up, and I would, you know, teach her when she was first starting. They were very, they liked that a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But even when it came to, you know, us wanting to do it professionally, they were always really supportive, which I know is not, you know, not always the case, so we're very lucky.
Are either of your parents, do they have, like, creative outlets in their life?
They do, but they're not, like, they wouldn't consider themselves artists, I think. I think they have definitely talents. My mom is, like, a great visual artist, making things with her hands, you know, quilting and collage and
oh, cool.
all that kind of stuff. Her mom, my grandma, was also really brilliant at that. My dad has things that he hasn't explored as well, for sure, you know, but they're mostly academics and community organizers and that kind of stuff. They teach, and they each have kind of also, like,
Okay, so this ties into a question I was going to ask, because I know you're really involved in activism, and I know that, like, you and Frankie did some outreach work together at school, but I mean, you're quite a bit younger than I am, and I feel like you've been involved in so much, and I was wondering where that activism started.
Yeah, definitely my parents and just my family. My dad is African-American. Mm-hmm. My mom has a very, like, complicated background, but she grew up in all Puerto Rican community in New York City. They're both, you know, very political. They both come from, like, all teachers on every side. No artists, just teachers.
That's amazing, teachers. Though.
Yeah, amazing. My mom is the founder of a curriculum called Roots of Success, which is the first environmental literacy curriculum, which gives people with, you know, low access to good education, low levels of the traditional skills, to basically learn about environmental literacy and be able to get the skills to enter the green economy. And it's mostly in high schools and as well as prisons, which is, you know, very important for people getting out who don't have access to much employment. And my dad is works in the Bay on youth violence prevention and focuses on trauma as an issue that's kind of unexplored and how the vital role that it plays in the levels of violence in low-income communities.
Yeah.
So they were always, yeah, that way, very, you know, radical. And even my name, Samora, I was named after Samora Michelle, who was the liberator of Mozambique, the head of the Liberation Army from the Portuguese anti-colonialist Pan-African leader, who was assassinated by the United States. So that probably tells you all.
So you got some history.
And their views towards U.S. policy. So, I mean, I was just lucky that, you know, to be able to grow up in that environment where they really stressed that it's important to be active in your community and to make the world, you know, better, no matter what you do. So, you know, obviously my outlet is the arts, but I also always try to be engaged in more on the ground ways as well, because I think for artists that's still important. Like, as great a role as we have to play as artists making art about those issues, and as much as that's needed, I still think it's important to be involved in more concrete ways, because those are the ways that things are going to get done.
Yeah. So you've been out of school for 4 years? 5 years?
Oh,
I'm lying.
3. Well, I graduated 2013, so I guess.
2013, okay.
3, yeah.
But I want to talk about your current project, which I guess I was thinking that because you said you've been working on it for 5 years.
Yeah.
So you started it while you were still at Juilliard.
Yeah, I don't remember what class Frankie was, but he might have been in the class with some of the people who were in the original version, because we did the first performance of it at Juilliard for the annual Martin Luther King Day celebration that at the time the Black Student Union put on at Juilliard. And it was like a giant production. Like, now we have way less people. But it was like 25, 30 people on stage.
Oh my gosh.
I remember Corey Hawkins was in it. Danielle Bruce was in it. Sekou was in it. Crazy. It was amazing. The first version was at Juilliard. And then was at first a collaboration between myself and this actor Christoph Abiel, and then that kind of got messed up. So then I restarted the project, and it became a collaboration between myself and Jeremy Harris, another actor.
Love Jeremy.
Amazing.
Wait, and this started before the MLK or after the MLK performance?
Yeah, the first performance was with me and Christoph, and then like a year later, like, kind of inspired by what that was. It was a very different thing, but there was some good things in it. So I took those, kind of, you know, reformed the piece, and then brought, you know, Jeremy on because I love his poetry, which no one knows about because he's this dope actor, but he never.
Yeah, he's a beautiful poet.
So we collaborated, you know, on this new thing. I kind of took some of his writings, asked him to write a couple other things, and then, you know, formed this new project called the Transformation Suite. And we did the second performance we did the first performances of that iteration of it in Brazil, but that was through Juilliard, actually, because they sent us there as one of their, like, outreach programs.
Like through the jazz department?
Through the jazz department, yeah. So that was why the original band, like, which is the same as the band for the album, is all Juilliard people except my sister.
Oh, amazing.
So I snuck her in there.
You've all stuck together.
Since it's a Juilliard project, obviously you have to bring all Juilliard musicians. So I just picked who I thought were the best people that were there at the time. And they sent us down there for 2 weeks to just do the project in Brazil, which was a very interesting way to first do it, like before ever before,
right?
Because they don't speak English.
Well, and it's also very much about American very issues,
but
you know.
What was interesting is the place that they sent us, which I was a part of making sure that they sent us there because I knew that it would be the right place, was Salvador in Bahia, which is the most African indigenous part of Brazil. You know, other places like Sao Paulo, Rio, they have definitely black people, but they're much less close to that cultural, like, underpinning and that history of the diasporic history,
yeah,
the slave trade, all that stuff. So for reasons I couldn't super explain to you now because I don't know the history that well, but Salvador is definitely the, like, the heart of the African indigenous kind of continuing cultural influence in Brazilian music, Brazilian dance, culture, and definitely the heritage. So, because we did it there, even though, like you said, like, it was written definitely from the African-American perspective, mostly, but definitely the overall American perspective as well, there was definitely very much diasporic elements in it because we were talking about the slave trade, we were talking about how the legacy of colonialism, legacy of slavery, you know, has persisted and transformed in different ways to, you know, lead us to where we are now as a country. So those things turned out like were very, you know, on the minds of the people there. So
yeah,
they were like loving it. And we had a really interesting conversations about the differences and the similarities of how the legacy of colonialism and African slavery, you know, enslaved peoples has led that country to where it is versus, you know, our country and how African people are treated, you know, African descendant people are treated there as opposed to here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Very different in certain ways, but also, you know, in certain ways very similar, and fortunately very similar and still basically the ways that they're disenfranchised in like every way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they definitely, it resonated a lot with them, and it was cool for that to be the first version because we saw very quickly that it was worldwide, you know, that it had that potential to speak to different people everywhere. And then to bring it back, it was a cool way to do that, you know.
So how long did it take you to do the like the meat of the composing, or was it all kind of like everything had to happen at once, the poetry and the music? And
yeah, it was like a weird,
did you know how big it would be, like when you started?
Backwards to I think usual, which is that because I knew I wanted it to be a suite, that's what I call the transformation suite, I really wanted it to be like kind of this very cohesive thing, like a concept record basically, or a piece. I didn't, at that time, I didn't even know I wanted it to be a record. I wrote program notes before I wrote any music. So I basically wrote, like, these are the sections, and this is what each section is about. And those sections are still that thing, you know? And it was almost like I was writing, like, an essay. That's because I come from an academic parent. So it was almost like the first section is the thesis statement, and then these are, like, the paragraphs that are, like, about eight different things, analyzing, and then the end is, like, the kind of conclusion, you know? We bring back the... We even bring it back at the end. Because you do that in, you know, symphonies and great pieces of music, too. Like, even Kendrick's record, where he, like, takes the pieces of poetry and then he says the poem at the end. Like,
yeah,
that's just a great musical device that is used as well in writing. So I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, and kind of did it like that. And then I wrote the music after. And I had one poem that I had heard Jeremy do, which was the reason that I wanted him. I actually hadn't even talk to him about writing more. I don't really know why. I like knew for some reason he would be able to write more dope stuff, but I had only heard this one piece that he did, and I knew exactly where it was going to go in this thing I was writing before I wrote the music. So I placed that when I was writing the music. Then I sent him that, and I was like, this is where that's going.
Is it okay if I use this?
No, straight up, I was like, listen, I need you, first of all, to use this. Second of all, I need you to write three more pieces for these other sections. Like, this is what they're about. So it was actually probably very constricting for him because it wasn't like he could just free write. I was like, this is what this thing is about, you have to write like a dope poem based on it. But he came back like literally, and the other thing was we had the tour, like this was when it was already scheduled. Like, I had certain things, and I had been writing for a long time, probably like almost a year. I had been writing in different pieces and things. But the meat of the music I pulled together in about a month. And then I asked him to write stuff in like 2.5 weeks. And so he came back
That's
with
not fair.
Really great stuff. And then I just edited a bit to work, and he was cool with my edits, and then we just did it. Like, it was very, it was definitely like a hurry up and wait kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was like a long process at the beginning to understand what it was about. And then once that happened, like, it was off and running. And so then, yeah.
But to have that relationship where you guys were so like on the same page that you can collaborate, even if it is last minute, or to know that the other one will be up for it. And like,
yeah. And then the other kind of backwards part about the process, which has also been very interesting, is that we did that in 2011. So we toured the in Brazil in like July or August 2011. And then we were like, oh, this is great. People are responding to it. We want to make a record. So I did a Kickstarter in 2011 to get the money to record it December of 2011. Like, almost all the music, I'd say 75% of the music was recorded in 2011. And then for like various other reasons, which, you know, I probably, you know, some of which I can speak about and others of which I cannot.
Okay.
But nothing involving bad people or no bad relationships, just basically like the process of learning about what the politics of making a record are and all
right,
that stuff,
right.
The details. It took us 5 years to get to the place where we can actually release the music. And we did have to record more stuff, re-record some things.
Yeah, I was going to say, so is some of what's on the record going to be from that initial session?
Yeah, I would
session?
Say about 70% of what's on the record
oh, wow.
was from 2011.
Wow. Well, and so what has the last couple of years been like for you? Have you felt like so much of the creative part of it was already done that you're just in the weeds with the producing part of it, or is it still been growing, like your idea of what it is or how you want to use it been growing?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what's been so interesting about it is when we wrote it in 2011, I mean, and people will hear this when, you know, when if they check out the music, like, it's the project is definitely about the American experience overall, but it's definitely centered in the Black American experience. And when we wrote it in 2011, part of, well, when I wrote, you know, especially the meat of the project, what I was trying to look at basically was what ended up happening now. I mean, because at the time, there were definitely people doing work. It was, you know, all over. There's always people doing great work. But it was before all this stuff really popped off, you know what I mean? So it was like, I was looking around at my generation being like, what are we going to do? Like, I don't see the impetus for like our new civil rights movement or whatever, Black Power, like
right.
those movements that other generations had built. Like, I don't see us doing that. How do we build it? So this was kind of my attempt at kind of getting a musical, like emotional response to people to say, we need to build this. And then obviously what's funny is like, now it's been built. So like the point of the album has like, and the music has changed a lot to just more be like reflecting or trying to be a part of and build forwards within this movement rather than to envision the movement, because the movement has already happened, you know what I mean? So that has been very interesting. And through the 5 years like that we've been working on the project, we have still been performing it live, like in lots of different places. We went to Costa Rica and performed it. We went to the West Coast, did it different, you know, in the Bay. We did it in LA, different schools like across, you know, we did it at Columbia, NYU, UC Irvine. I mean, basically the only place we haven't gone in the United States has been the South, actually. We have not gone to the South yet with the project. Yeah, so the piece has changed a lot, you know, just in how we perform it and how we represent it. And one of the things that I try to do with it when I do it live is to make it very malleable. So wherever we go with it, I'll do reconnaissance beforehand and be like, what are the people in this space like fighting for that they're not getting? And then I'll incorporate it into the piece, you know, and talk to them about how they want to use that stage. Because for me, the piece is like, it's to be used. It's not, I mean, hopefully artistically by itself, it also has merit. But for me, it was always piece of work to be used, hopefully, that people can use for something. And that was the only, also, honestly, the only reason it's coming out, because it wasn't the last 5 years of me continuously doing work. It was basically like, we did a lot of work in 2011. Some things happened in the beginning of 2012 that kind of made it seem like it was impossible to do. And then I just was like, this is not, I'm done. Like, this is not coming out, like, for, like, a good 2 years, almost.
Mm-hmm.
But I had given it to some people, like, friends and different people that I trusted and wanted to hear about how they felt, like, earlier, before I kind of gave up on it. And then when all the stuff happened, like, when Eric Garner's, when, I'm trying to remember the cat, the police officer that killed him, that got off, man, I should know his name, but I'm blanking right now. Because I won't say all the names of the other cops that got off.
Yeah, I don't know his name, I'm sorry.
Grant, or like Darren Wilson who killed Mike Brown, but I don't remember the name of the officer. But anyways, when he was exonerated by the grand jury, like, you know, obviously people were, like, devastated, you know, around the country, and I had people hitting me, like, I was listening to the project, like, you need to put this out, like, this is what got me through it, which was never, you know, I never would have expected that, and people, you know, sending me that kind of information, that was what made me, like, want to be, like, kind of leap over the hurdles that I had at that time to feel like it was important enough for me to spend the time and money to, like, you know, get those kind of things out of the way to be able to release it.
Yeah.
So it was only really like the last year or so that I kind of came back to the project and was like, I'm going to, you know, figure out how to make this work.
Yeah. I was reading the descriptions you had on the website and you said something about like music being a soundtrack for a revolution or for movements. And I was just like, that's so interesting to think of it as like music being useful in that kind of taking a stand or that kind of action, which I'm sure is so obvious to you, but sometimes so people put the arts in the background so much that it's,
yeah, totally.
You need to be reminded that like, oh yeah, those are active things.
Right.
We're all trying to change with them.
Yeah. I think from the cultural perspective I saw, but you know, like I think what's interesting is I think that just came naturally from my barometers for success, talking about what you're talking about. Like,
mm-hmm.
My barometers for success were never, like, get a Grammy or, like, sell a bunch of records. Not that I wouldn't want to do those things, but my barometers for success were, like, are people chanting this in the streets? Like, that's why I'm jealous of Kendrick Lamar. Not because he has hella Grammys, but because people are singing We Gonna Be Alright in the streets. Like,
that's pretty amazing.
That's the best thing about it for me, you know? So that was always my goal. Now, obviously, I don't have control over whether people, like, think that they want to do that or not.
Yeah.
With the Transformation Suite. But what I will say is, like, the coolest things that have happened with it have been the things that I don't expect that are like that. Like, you know, a friend of mine that has used it for his curriculum with his high school class for African American history.
Oh, cool.
Or a friend of mine who's doing, like, a fashion show based on those concepts, you know, for her, like, thesis that she was going to do a totally different thing, you know, and then listen to the piece. Or, you know, like, yeah, just different random things that people, you know, were inspired to do through listening and engaging with the material, you know, that's cool. Well, actually, the thing I'm most excited about is that the album release, which is the day before, we're released on October 12th, but the album release is going to be on October 11th, and I'm collaborating with this organization called Campaign for Black Male Achievement, which is a national organization that works to change perceptions for young black males and also to give them more opportunities to succeed.
Uh-huh.
We are doing the Transformation Suite album release at the Kennedy Center as part of an event that we're presenting, that I'm presenting with them, called Black Males Reimagine, where we bring together different artists and different speakers to basically speak on different aspects of the, you know, black male experience specifically, but the black experience. Engaging with, you know, the prison industrial complex, violence, you know, police violence, obviously, poverty, all those kind of things, but also engaging with patriarchy, you know, intersectionality, the issues that, you know, black males have had in terms of how they treat black females. Like, we're trying to deal with all those things too. But anyways, basically, we're using the Transformation Suite as a framework to bring all these people together and put put on this free event for like schools, you know, throughout the
That's so exciting.
So I'm really excited about that. And the people who are a part of it are like really great.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
Was that something that you spearheaded or like somebody heard it and was like, let's do this?
It was kind of a combination of those things, but basically it was through a confluence of factors of just great people, basically. But I'm a part of an organization called Blackout for Human Rights, which was started by Ryan Coogler and Ava DuVernay, actually.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, mostly filmmakers. And we've done a couple different, you know, great events that I've been a part of and different actions and are planning more. But basically one of the members of Blackout, one of the core members, was also a member of CBMA, who I'm, you know, presenting this event with. And they came to, I invited them to one of the performances of the Transformation Suite. And after the performance, he said, you know, we do this biannual event called Black Male Reimagined, and we don't know what we're doing this year. You know, I think it would be a great idea to structure it around this project. And I was like, yes, of course, you know. So I'm just very grateful to them that they're willing to take that chance, you know, and that they're willing to let me be a core part of the process and how it's built, who we asked to be a part of it, and how we kind of curate, you know, the whole event through the prism of the suite. So, it was kind of...
That's really exciting.
Through, you know, my friend Rashid, who's a member of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement.
Are you doing anything the next day in New York, like when you actually release it?
I will be doing...
Or will you be asleep in your bed?
We will be doing probably a couple different things in New York. I cannot announce them yet because they're not confirmed.
Well, let me know when you know.
Shooting for the stars, but I will definitely let you know when I know. And there, yes, we definitely will have some type of thing within either on the day of or in the next couple of days after that for the New York folks, because they hold me down. So.
Are you just feeling so excited to like have? I know that so many people have already heard it, obviously, and good things have been happening. But are you excited just to be like, I'm putting this thing out of my heart and into the world, and my hands are going to be off it for a little bit. Let's see what it does.
It's a weird feeling, you know. It's almost like, obviously it's not like this because I don't have children, so I don't know what it's like. But I feel like it's the closest I'll currently get to like having a child, and then like being like, you have to like leave the house, you know what I mean? Like go do your thing. But it's like, that's kind of like, it's a tough thing, but it's also like, you know, hopefully liberating, and also hopefully like, you know, it'll just be interesting to see what that person
what happens
is
and
how people respond to that person, you know. So I'm nervous, but I'm excited, and definitely I think I'll be relieved that I can move on to other things in a certain type of way.
I mean, I'm sure you'll continue to do work with it in live shows and stuff. But I wanted to ask you, just because this podcast deals so much with like the reality of being an artist the day to day, how have you been structuring your like financial life since you graduated from school? Like, have you been able to pay most of your bills with music, or have you been day jobbing it here and there?
I mean, I've been lucky to not, you know, to be able to pay my bills with music. But part of that was that, obviously, you know, one thing was I Juilliard was the only music school I applied to. I applied to all academic schools, and I really wanted to go, but the only reason that I did go was because they gave me a full scholarship. I wouldn't have gone because I really didn't want to have loans. And my parents were like, being academic people themselves, they were like, we're not going to, like, we won't let you go if you have loans, you know?
Yeah.
So that was really helpful. And then also, on top of that, I stayed with my grandfather the whole time.
Oh my gosh.
It was a blessing because I love him. and also a little bit of wrangling because they didn't want to let me do that. But at a certain point, I was just like, I have to do this.
I mean, that's one of the biggest expenses going to school in New York is living expenses.
Yeah, and so I was lucky that, you know, my grandpa, he's a born and bred New Yorker. And so I lived with him the whole time I was in school, which allowed me to save a lot of money. And, you know, was still gigging and performing during that time, and just tried to save really well because I knew that, you know, when I was leaving, I wanted to take certain creative risks, and I needed to have some money, you know, put away if I was going to be able to not have a day job or something like that. So I think that situation allowed me to save enough that I was like cool for a little bit till I could kind of work out, you know, what I want, what I wanted and needed to work out. And yeah, I mean, I do a lot of different things to cover the situation, you know, musically or artistically, but so far I've been lucky enough to be able to do that. Also, you know, I live with my sister, and she, even though she's in school, like, tours, like, a lot. Like, way more than most people in school. So she covers her end, too, you know, like, which is great. And we're able to kind of do our thing. I mean, we don't have a lot of expenses, you know, being young people, which is helpful. But, yes.
That's so great that you have family here.
It's been really a blessing, yeah. And it was great to, you know, I lived with my grandfather for 6 years till he passed away, you know. And I mean, beyond everything, just personally, it was the most special thing in my life. But it was definitely also really, really helpful from the standpoint that I didn't, you know, that I was able to save for a long time and kind of like charge everything to him. Like I could, I mean, I also took care of him. So it wasn't just the one thing because he was old. And so me and then my sister, when she first moved here, before he passed away, we took care of him. So we made all his meals, we got his medicine, we, you know, made sure he had everything he needed. But, you know, because of that, like, I was like, bro, you're covering these groceries. Okay. So that, yeah, it was helpful. I mean, for sure, for those first years to be able to save that money and then be able to start take certain risks because you know, I toured a lot, like, when I first got out of school because I was kind of scared of those kind of things. And, like, I was just like, I need to work. And I toured with some great people who I love, but I realized that I wanted to, you know, do my thing and that I wanted to be multidisciplinary and work in a lot of different fields and compose mostly more than play. Although I love playing, I wanted to be a composer. And so I had to start saying no to some of those things that paid better, you know. And so it was a little hairy for a little bit, but and then definitely with this album, like, you know, I decided mostly because of the subject matter and how I wanted to treat how I released it, like, in certain respects, I decided to release it independently, you know, not with a label, and that came with a lot of costs as well.
Yeah.
So I had to invest a lot in myself, which is how I, you know, try to put it, but I've been
That's
lucky
great,
that
though.
I'm able to do that because, you know, not, I understand that not everyone is able to do that.
Is there anything that you learned specifically, like, nitty-gritty putting out your own album? Things that surprised you that you learned about that process that might be useful to someone else who's like, oh, I'd like to produce my own music?
Yes, I have learned a great deal. The biggest thing is, I mean, I'm a big fan of collaboration, and I'm also a big fan of inspiration. You know, I like to get my inspiration sources and then just throw them in the pot. But the one thing about that is, like, definitely get permission for everything you use before you do anything. So that's, like, that was a big thing that I had to learn. There's just a lot of, like you said, kind of nitty-gritty or, like, detail aspect things from the independent side that you just wouldn't think of, but are really good to know about, like, just what digital distribution means, what physical distribution means, like, what you really need to be able to do those things. Even just as far as, like, artistic layout, if you want to do a booklet, or, like, ISRC codes, like, I had never heard about any of those things. No, nobody tells you that, like, you need ISRC codes for each song on the album if you're going to track where the money goes, you know what I mean?
Oh, like, okay. It's just really, I don't know anything about that.
Stuff, but it's like, if you're going to go with a digital distributor to get your music on Apple Music, Spotify, iTunes, whatever, all that stuff, you need these codes for them to be that kind of hub to be able to track when people buy things from these various sites, so that then you can get that money. So it's just like that kind of stuff I didn't even know or think about until I had to do it.
Did you just do a lot of research, or did you find some friends and mentors?
I have great producers for the album.
Okay.
Greg Knowles and James Fallon, who have been really helpful to me throughout the process. They were there since we recorded all the way till now, and have been kind of great advisors to me on warning me about those kind of things, like, you know, a little bit before I had to, like, freak out. So they've kind of been the number one helpers for me on that end, as well as just great friends who have advised me, you know, like my friend Steph and Frida and my friend Esther, like just yeah, good people in my life who've just been like, oh, you want to do that? This is how you do it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Is there something in the past couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? Like a lesson you've learned, or it doesn't have to be like a huge thing.
That's a great question. What am I proud of? There's a couple things I could mention. I mean, just, I guess the most recent thing that I can think of is, having the courage to start singing in front of people. That's a very new thing.
Have you always sung when you're alone?
I actually haven't. I mean, not any more than any normal person, just randomly. But, I toured, you know, a few years ago and until recently with lots of different great singers, you know, Jose James, Emily King, Kate Davis, like all of those, you know, some of the great singers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I was in their bands, and so they would ask me to do backgrounds and stuff, which was cool how I started to get a little comfortable, but... What happened was, you know, my sister's a vocalist, an amazing vocalist, and we're getting her music ready, you know, to record and all that stuff, and so I was writing a lot of stuff for her, and I always wrote music, but I didn't write lyrics till probably the last, like, 3 years, that's kind of some of the reasons why I asked somebody like a Jeremy to collaborate with me, because I had, at that point, it wasn't even a question in my mind that I'd be able to even write, like, written material for something that I created. But when we started writing together, me and my sister, she was like, you're gonna write these lyrics, right? I was like, yeah, sure. And I loved it. Like, I had so much fun with it. And I think it's something I actually ended up being, I think I'm pretty good at it. So I started writing just my own stuff on the side, lyrics, you know. And at first, it was always... to have her sing it, or to have like my friend Jabril, like great singers, sing it. But then when I started to like teach it to them, they were like, first of all, like this is in your, like this is not in our range or anything. Like I would be like, no, that's not how you sing it. They're like, we don't sing that way. Like, you have to sing it that way. If you're going to sing it, if it's going to be performed that way, you have to do it. I was like, oh.
Maybe that was your subconscious trying to tell you something.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, it's just weird. I mean, I had never even thought about that before, mostly just because so many of my friends are like the best singers. So it's just like weird, you know, but lots of people encouraged me, and like, you know, so I started doing this new project, which will be my next project after the Transformation Suite, which is like totally a whole different thing. A very, you know, personal project about kind of things we started out talking about, actually.
Okay.
Just about like personal demons and relationships and all that kind of stuff, but it's called Venus. The band is called Venus, and so I started writing just a collection of songs around that kind of stuff. And my sister was like, "You should do it. You should perform." And that was like, we did it at Rockwood in like, I can't remember, probably June or something, June or something. It's one of the scariest things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
And people loved it. It was really weird to me. What? Like, so, yeah, we just kept going. So I guess.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's a thing. It's still weird that it's a thing to me, but.
And you were playing while you were singing?
Yeah. That will be an interesting next chapter. But yeah, I think I'm proud of myself that I didn't just automatically shut that down, because there were a lot of times when I wanted to do that, because I was just like, you know, when you're really good at something else, like, which, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to say I'm the best pianist, but I've spent a lot of time doing that. I've studied it. So when you are at a certain level with one thing, and then this other thing, like, you're...
It's scary.
Scratch, you're like, you know that you're not as good, and you have... You know what it means to put time into something. And
right.
Be,
and you know people who have put in the time for that, and you're like, that's
so
what a singer is.
Kind of, you know, it's weird. It's like weird to be like, that's okay.
Yeah, you just have to try it and keep trying it. I've had a lot of like actor friends talk about like playwriting that way.
Right.
Like, oh, you just have to start and try.
Yeah. I think my sister was that way for composing, because I was always a composer. And then when she started having her music, I would write a lot for her. But I also was like, Lainey, like, you can write. And it was like that for her. Like, she had to to get the confidence to even start. And then when she did it, like, she wrote great songs. You know, her songs are amazing. So,
do you ever get writer's block as a composer?
Yeah, I'm very inconsistent. I'll, like, write certain things in, like, a night, you know, and then other things will take me a year. It really just depends on what it is. And I think I'm getting less writer's block now because I opened something up for me, which was very important, which is interesting, is that I think I allowed myself to have imagination and to write about things that weren't just my experience, like my mm-hmm. literal experience. I still have certain limits around, like, there are probably certain things I'll never write about just because I don't feel comfortable writing about them. And I think there are certain things that you have to experience to really know how to write about. But I do think that it opened up a lot of possibilities for me to be like, not everything has to be something I went through, you know? And I started to do that also through just writing for other people, you know, writing for my sister, writing for, yeah, just lots yeah. of other folks that asked me to write for them. So, yeah,
that's helpful. So are you pretty chill, if you do have something where you're like, this is, I don't know what to do with this now, are you pretty chill about just knowing that, oh, well, that this is going to be one of the ones that takes me a year, I'll come back to it next month and look at it, or is it frustrating, and what do you do to try to get out of that?
I mean, I definitely get frustrated pretty easily, but I think my natural way is to be doing hella different stuff at the same time, both in terms of, like, the projects I'm involved in, but also just how I work, so I tend to just, like, if I get frustrated, I'll just be frustrated for, like, 5 minutes, and then I'll be like, F it.
Just, like, switch just, like, gears.
Go to something else.
Cause yeah.
Not even because it's necessarily the right way to do it, just because I'm just like, I don't want to deal with this right now. Go do this other thing. So, yeah, I think that's actually ended up serving me because, like, sometimes it makes sense to, you know, it's a really, like, intuitive process. Like, you have to know when you're on the verge and you just need to push. And you also have to know when, if you push, you might just not get what's real. You know, you might get something that sounds forced, and if it sounds forced, it's going to be whack. So
yeah,
if there's that if you're at that point, you're better off putting it away and coming back. But if you're, like, just encountering some barriers, but you feel that it's something on the other side of you, sometimes you got to just endure.
If you are having one of those dark side days and where you're feeling really uninspired and don't know what to do, are there any concrete things that you reach for again and again, like a book or an album or a place you go?
Yeah, definitely certain music. That's definitely the first place that I go, for sure. Frank Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Terrence Blanchard. Who else? Andre. I think those are kind of the mains for me. At this point in time, I'm sure it changes. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I'm necessarily, like, great at navigating those certain times. I think my family helps me out, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think I just, like, know how to not make it worse. You know, like, I know that it's like, oh, this is this type of day. Maybe it'll pass. I just need to do what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, like, making it a bigger thing than it is, you know? And that allows it to pass, and then I can just kind of be cool. Whereas before, it would last a lot longer because I would make it a lot more of, like, an existential, like, this
right.
is where I'm at.
Right. Yeah, knowing that it'll pass is very, very helpful, even though it still feels terrible when you're there.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to ask if you had, like, heard or seen anything recently that you wanted to recommend.
Yeah. I'm really excited about Ava DuVernay's new documentary, The 13th, which is debuting at New York Film Festival this week. I haven't seen it yet, but I know it's going to be dope. I saw a trailer, and it's coming out on Netflix. I'm mm-hmm. extra hype, you know, to see it. Because everything she does
she's amazing. Best. Have and you also, watched Queen Sugar yet?
I watched the first episode. That's definitely something I would recommend.
I've been enjoying
it.
It's
so fire. I would also recommend Atlanta. You know,
I haven't seen that yet.
It's so extra fire as well. They're both brilliant. Yeah, I love Queen Sugar. Love Atlanta. I love, what's the new Derek Hodge's new record. This I think it's called Second. The Second, I think that's what it's called. What else is the new stuff? Robert Glasper Experiment record. The new one is good. It's great. Frank Ocean's new record is great. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure everyone knows that at this point. What else of the other things? I'm trying to think other.
Or are there any like with your activism work, are there any organizations in the city that you would recommend people getting involved yes. with or checking out what they're doing?
That's a much easier question. Really, Hoodies for Justice.
Okay.
I think to me they're the most important New York-based organization. New York Justice League does great work too. And then the more like national organizations that I think are the most important, definitely Black Youth Project 100, BYP 100. Does amazing work. Dream Defenders in Miami, obviously the Black Lives Matter Network, and also on the, basically what people should check out if they want to know like what's the national platform is actually called the Movement for Black Lives. So a lot of people don't know that because they think Black Lives Matter is like everybody, but Black Lives Matter is a hashtag first and foremost, but it's also, it is a network, it's an organization, but it's a loose network of local chapters.
Okay.
So each local chapter has their own agenda. They can do their own thing. And so there's like Black Lives Matter New York, Black Lives Matter LA, all those kind of things. But what unites all the local, all the organizations nationally, like, you know, Black Lives Matter, Million Hoodies, BYP, Ferguson Action, Dream Defenders, all those, basically they all came together and put out this national policy statement that's under the banner of the Movement for Black Lives.
Okay.
So if you go search the Movement for Black Lives, you'll find their website and you'll find the list of demands, the list of, you know, policy points, all that kind of stuff that everybody's asked for and says we don't have because they want to hate. So that's like the, you know, that's what to look for and understand.
Okay.
And then obviously there's new stuff like springing up every day, like, you know, this with Charlotte and what is happening, the uprising that's happening there right now. They just put out a list of demands that you can also just like, you can find it, you know, pretty much everywhere on social media, but if you want to find it fast through this, like, it is on my, you know, social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. I try to repost the things that I see, because I'm obviously not in Charlotte right now, but,
right.
You know, like Rosa Clemente was just there, who was an important organizer, Pastor Michael McBride, so those are people I know that I get the information from, and then I try to spread it, you know, to my own network, but things are coming out all the time. You just have to know what are the right channels, which is important because there's lots of plans. You know,
there's a lot of misinformation for sure. Okay, great. Well, October 12th.
Yes,
October 12th. Seat. It's all going to be coming out, and I'll post all about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm really excited. You can get it pretty much everywhere. And then also one thing that I am trying to do is for organizations, like obviously policy, political, you know, activist organizations, but also for youth groups, I will have a digital free package that will include the whole record and also other educational materials that I can give to those, you know, organizations. They can spread however they want because I want the younger people to get it that way.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure. Thank you. So Samora was kind enough to let me include a track from the Transformation Suite. This is the second song. It's entitled History.
Sweat and blood, blisters and sores, sun rays piercing through our gaze, leaving holes in our todays, murdering any hope for tomorrow. What happened to that God you spoke of? punched down my throat, kicked in my face. I ain't seen them in your eyes lately. I ain't heard them in your words. You even walking like the devil these days. With a sly shift, a crooked grin, smirking at the dollar signs of tomorrow, sealing your eyes from the horrors of today. Don't you choke on that hate you cooked in that awful scented kitchen of pain. Tell me why you lied, and was it worth it? The culture you called stool, stepped on and then stole. The malignant markings you left on the souls of folk, scratching for breath in the land that calls them pariah for trying to breathe. The secondhand murders you had a first hand in creating. The love you sold, smashed and shoved into the holes of ships, to grow rancid, rot and fester, to ooze, bubble and pus, to die in the darkness. So tell me, was it worth it?
Thank you.
Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.